what are the prerequisite qualities of a proper, effective vision? It needs to be inspiring, and it needs to be inevitable.
Maybe it was always there in humanity and we just couldn't see it. But boy, social media make it obvious that the assholes stand out and they get followers. And at least for a time, they're rewarded.
From Orion X, this is the Marketing Podcast. Marketing has transformed in significant ways. More technology, more data, more social, more blending of arts and sciences, more integrated with every other function, and ultimately more critical to the organization. Join Shaheen Khan and Doug Garnett as they discuss news and happenings in the world of marketing, from the boardroom to customer programs.
Hi, everybody. Marketing Podcast. This is Shaheen Khan with Doug Garnett, and it's episode number 47, Doug, isn't it?
It is. It is. Wow. Time passes.
Is 47 a prime number?
I believe it is. Yeah, I believe it is. But what's even better is two from now, we're into the square of seven, and that's a cool number, too.
That's right. And just to confirm, you're right. 47 is, in fact, the prime number. Is there an oon in the cart?
There is an oon in the cart, and we're returning to Tom Fishburne. You can find him at marketoonist.com. And the latest one looks at thought leadership, and because we all want to be a thought leader, maybe. Anyway, so a guy asks probably a consultant, says, oh, how do I become a thought leader? And she says, oh, it's easy. You just post every 6 hours, 5 videos and 4 images and 1 poll a week, 17 comments a day minimum, and that's just on LinkedIn. To which the guy who asked the question asks, so when do I have time to think? And the truly modern answer is, oh, AI is going to take care of that part.
Yeah, of course.
You can become a thought leader just by no longer having thoughts. Just let AI.
So my immediate reaction, as I normally would say now, was step one, quantity over quality. Step two, let's outsource the quality.
Unfortunately, I do think there are some people who become very well-known thought leaders by doing that. And there are people who become very well-known thought leaders by having thoughts. So
it also reminds me of, I once took one of these executive education programs that was conducted by the venerable Stanford Business School. And the professor said, it was all about vision. It was vision, strategy, etc. And the professor said, so where do you get a vision? And I reflexively just blurted out, from a visionary, which I think is really pretty valid, that there's no really process to come up with a vision that actually is a vision. And then if I can change the topic a little bit more than I already have, got me thinking about what are the prerequisite qualities of a proper effective vision. And I came up with, it requires 2 attributes. It needs to be inspiring and it needs to be inevitable. And if you have that, then you have a good, compelling vision. Because if it's inspiring but not inevitable, then it's a pie in the sky. And if it's inevitable but not inspiring, then it's ho-hum and what else is new, right?
Yeah.
So if you have both, now you can latch onto it and people will join because it's going to happen anyway, with or without you.
You know, it's interesting as you talk about that, though. I was thinking, there's a quote from John Ivey, who was at Apple as a design head.
Right.
And I don't remember the exact words, but he points out the unusual reality, which is one moment there's no idea or vision, the next moment there is. And this is the really unusual thing about human brains and how we work. And that circles me back to this cartoon, because that's the human reality, is there's no vision and then suddenly there is. And it's because that's the way our brains work. The AI approach to the same thing is, there's no vision 1 minute and then it researches everything from the past and gives you something that is a rehash simply of what has been, not of anything. And they're not the same. Not the same.
They're not the same. Yeah, that's excellent.
Oh, I was going to say, the other fascinating question is, what do we expect a thought leader is? By the term itself, you would expect that a thought leader is that person on the old maps that's off exploring the areas that say dragons be here or lions, and it's in those dangerous areas. I think that in the industrialization of being a thought leader, thought leaders tend these days to live in the warm, safe, cozy territory of a back deck with a martini in their hand.
So. Yeah, actually, that's a really good topic. What is a thought leader? So I always reflexively would say a thought leader is the agenda setter. Mm-hmm. If you're setting the agenda in your industry, in your area, product area, technology area, whatnot, then that is good evidence that you're a thought leader as a company or as an individual. And that requires some kind of a disruption, some kind of a change to whatever it was happening before. And sometimes that's the area is ripe for it, and sometimes it isn't. So that becomes the other, you can't just declare thought leadership in an area.
No, in fact, the thing I would expect from a thought leader is that they should discover the challenging things. I know that working with clients, I always had an ability to look at situations and articulate stuff that was going on in ways that were new to them. In other words, my thought, I could think it through and articulate and grasp the clarity that was needed in that moment. And that was a tremendous value. I think these days it's become an industrial position where you build followers and you try to have a lot of followers, so forth and so on. And maybe it starts by surprising people with clarity about what's happening or those kinds of things. But I think we're seeing less often about a person who's able to articulate something in a new way. And once you hear it in that new way, you can't unhear.
Relevant to this is the new Nike ad that I saw online and we talked about.
Yeah, Nike put out a big new release of a new ad. It's up on YouTube in a minute and a half version. I'm sure they've got cutdowns for all kinds of formats, things like that. And the ad is benignly titled, "Winning Isn't for Everyone," which I think we all can go. It's a little bit of an odd title, but yeah, of course that's true. But the ad's fundamental content is, am I a bad person? And it continually asks this question through it of, am I a bad person? And it's, am I a bad person for all these things? And it just goes through, I'm selfish. Does that make me a bad person? I'm an asshole. Does that make me a bad person? I like to beat other people and walk away without empathy. Does that make me a bad person? And it just leads to this bad taste in my mouth where I get done and I'm like, is this really what you're saying about yourselves?
Yeah, I am really curious whether this ad is working for them. Mm-hmm. Because if it is, it requires a whole bunch of recalibrations on my part and say, okay, you know, what did I miss? But I did not like it one bit. It was not on brand. It wasn't about pursuit of excellence. It was about looking mean and angry. And even the thumbprint is like this young man frowning. We mean business here. It was like that sort of a thing. And I just don't know if any of that is on brand. Just Do It was excellent, was empowering without being edgy. This one, like, winning isn't for everyone. So right there, I'm never going to win a 100-meter dash ever. So just to get me to go for a slow jog is not a bad goal for somebody. Like, so they're not doing that. And then, am I a bad person? I don't know. Maybe you are. They did not conclusively close that by saying, therefore, I am not a bad person. I'm just pursuing excellence.
I think, yeah, I mean, if you look at what they think they're doing, because you always have to get inside the head of whoever made it and why Nike would have approved it, is that Nike has always leveraged the idea of top-level competitors, right? And they've always used top-level competitors in their ads. But the fundamental Nike brand has been the Just Do It, which is a wide open and led by these people who are superb. But they're always portrayed as inspirational people that we could want to be like.
Exactly.
And things like that. Here, it's a kick them out if you're not as badass as, if you're not as rude and mean to other people as me, then what are you doing here? Because winning isn't for everything and all we care about is winning. It may be that Nike thinks they need to remake a statement to the top level athletes, but I think it's a bad one. And it's one of these cases that advertisers get into where, by communicating with a highly targeted market, which is those type of elite athletes, they may well be offending everybody else. And I saw this, Burger King has done this, where they did some ads maybe 10 years ago. They had the creepy king, who was this right, kind of emaciated, weird looking creepy king. And the justification from the agency is, we're targeting 18 to 22 year old males. The problem is you're on national TV. So your ad's being seen by everybody. And if you offend parents, you may be targeting 40% of your market and rejecting 30% of it. That trade-off is not good.
Yeah.
Everybody will see your ad. So you have to make it with in mind that everybody will see your ad. And it's not okay if you're Nike to offend anybody.
Yeah. So here, instead of excel, it's win.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're confusing excellence with winning. Mm-hmm. They're confusing hard work towards perfection, the relentless pursuit of perfection, as Lexus used to say. They're confusing that with a gold medal.
And they're confusing, you know? Get out and be active and do things. And if you engage the sport and you want to get better, we're here for you. And all those kind of messages with all of a sudden they've lost those people. I think intriguingly, and we'll come back to the initial cartoon, but intriguingly to me, there's that LinkedIn article that came out, I don't know, 2-3 weeks ago.
Yes, that's right. About a month ago, yeah.
A brand guy at Nike, and it talks about their direct-to-consumer disaster because Nike is running as fast as they can away from that, although I'm not sure they know how to run away from that, but we'll see how that goes.
Right.
But within it, there was a really interesting segment where this author observes that by walking away from the wholesale channel, Nike lost a lot of occasional buyers. And in a brand like Nike, you may portray your brand as aspirational and pulling people forward and therefore focus on elite athletes. But if you're a healthy mass market brand, you need a very large number of occasional buyers. The light buyers are critical to success. In fact, there's a study about Dove that I don't have in front of me right now, but it showed during a period of exceptional growth for Dove, 80% of their buyers bought once a year or less.
Wow.
During that time. And it really was, it's stunning. Maybe it's not 80% there. I have the, reach out to me if you want the link to it. Mm-hmm. But the point was a huge number of the people making Dove into a healthy brand were buying only one time a year or less. And that's it's a little shocking. All the Pareto effect stuff, all the idea about focus on your biggest customers flies in the face of it. But on the other hand, when you really sit back and look at it, those people who are your light buyers today are the only ones who can replace the heavy buyers that disappear. And there will always be heavy buyers disappearing. And so you've always got to be bringing people in. It's a really critical part of things. And for Nike to walk away from those is a very serious business error. I doubt if they understood that going to direct to consumer would cause that problem. But I would say in retrospect, it's inevitable. You can have a healthy direct to consumer brand that does have like buyers involved with it and be good at a certain small size, but they're Nike. That small size isn't there. And inevitably, you cannot offend or lose those direct-to-consumer or those occasional buyers. And they lost them.
That's right. That's right. So another angle on this was maybe they're responding to the cultural shift towards the influencer world that we live in or the celebrity culture that we have. And if that's the world you live in, then the idea of winning and being present and being in the news and having that kind of visibility is what people respond to. That is possible, as much as I think the approach towards it is distasteful. Mm-hmm. Can it be that it is that?
I don't know, but I think it's, I don't know for sure, but it's clearly influenced by it. These people in this ad do remind me of the people desperately searching for clicks on Twitter. Who are saying offensive things, people who use offensive statements in order to get responses, people who go more and more extreme in everything they say because they win the battle for followers by doing it.
That's right.
And it is, we do have a, we're at a cultural moment, very happy with those. Maybe only because it's so obvious. Maybe it was always there in humanity and we just couldn't see it. But boy, does social media make it obvious that the assholes stand out and they get followers. And at least for a time, they're rewarded. And what we don't often see is how it's dystopian and very many, a lot of the people that are rewarded then end up losing out in the long run. So
they're famous
for their 15 minutes of fame, and then they lose those bad.
I think the trouble is that those downsides don't come in early enough to be a corrective signal. They come at the end where you have a massive fall from grace and then it's over, rather than, hey, maybe you want to curb your,
A little bit. I would expect when you're an influencer and it's building, it's if you're a new person in sports and you're building fame, you probably feel like it's inevitable that it'll just continue. What is very hard to remember in sports is that sports writers make destroying the person that's at the top of the heap. That's a game for them, right? The sports writers go out and they're like, oh, that's the best quarterback in the league. Time for some dirt. Go and seek it out. So that in sports, there's this constant thing. When somebody reaches the top of the heap, they're about to fall.
And I actually think, like you're saying, the business model that you tap into is a huge part of this problem. If you are helping make money for people who are therefore incented to let the party carry on, then you eventually run out of good ideas, and then you run out of bad ideas, and then you have to go into even more.
Maybe the reality we ought to take from it is that people who are building up to that stage fail to understand that it's a very small step from the top of the heap to the falling off the cliff. That in a sense, being a social media success is highly unstable. It doesn't take much for that house of cards to fall because, in fact, it's a house of cards. You know, you've built it on the accident of celebrity. And the accident of celebrity very easily becomes the accident of becoming the goat.
So the way to preserve that is to turn it into a cult. Mm-hmm. So now you eliminate logic from your fans who are diehard, devoted, rain or shine, all evidence be damned. If you get to that point, then you can preserve it for a good while, but that just makes it even a higher mountain to fall off of. If you got there for bad reasons, yeah, then it will happen. And
I suppose the good business model for it would be to get to that level of success and then move into some other kind of business. We see it among Hollywood celebs who build celebrity, but then start doing their own business on the side. And their celebrity may contribute to that business, but they end up building solid businesses that are separate, in a sense, from celebrity having to be there. You were mentioning that Kim Kardashian, we don't see much of Kim anymore. But I do know that on her way up, she was also investing in and building other stuff. So maybe she's built an empire she can go run without having to be constantly in the headlines.
Yeah, I think the litmus test is how badly you need to be in the news every day. I think some of the people that you mentioned who are doing a good job of parlaying their celebrity status into some, most often, like contributing to society, doing some good things, but also making money and all, they do it quietly. They do it on the side. They may get noticed. They may come, but they don't need it. They don't look like it's their oxygen.
Yeah, and I've only discovered it because eventually you think, wow, where did that person go? And then you do a little digging and you realize, oh, God, they're off doing what they'd rather do.
So the other thing we mentioned as part of this Nike ad was the digital direct-to-consumer strategy that they had that didn't work. That same topic came up in our pre-call about our now third topic, which is Starbucks, which we have talked about a couple of few episodes ago with what sort of problems they were facing. And all of that culminated with a new CEO that was announced. So let's tee that up because I think digital is a piece of that puzzle as well.
Well, it is. And I think actually what we're seeing with all these things, and especially as we dig into the Starbucks question, is that we've reached this point of, I suppose it was called omnichannel. But we've reached this point where now people have different sales channels. And what we're seeing is a lot of companies struggle to figure out how to make that work. It's hard to have these multiple sales channels and somehow find the right strategy through it all, I would say. And especially in the food business, Starbucks just this week fired, probably not too bad a word, the last CEO, the one that led to the big stock drop that we talked about in an episode two or three times ago. And Starbucks revenues have been struggling. As a company, they've been struggling. So they let him go and they have hired a guy named Brian Niccol. And Niccol was most recently CEO of Chipotle, and he'd been at Chipotle since 2018. Before that, he spent about 13 years, I believe it is, at Yum Brands, which we're all like, Yum Brands, what the heck is that? But of course, the marketers who know are like, we know that. It's Kentucky Fried Chicken and Pizza Hut and Taco Bell, among other brands. And he had a stint just before he went to Chipotle as CEO of Taco Bell, where good things happen for Taco Bell. So Starbucks now has a new guy at the helm with Brian Niccol, and he starts in September. What do you think?
First off, I love the B2C consumer packaged goods industry because marketing people with some frequency become CEOs. Mm-hmm. So the career path for mm-hmm. marketing folks is pretty good.
That's true. And his background is a marketing guy. So to be clear, he started out, the history is apparently he started into engineering and then took some marketing classes and said, oh, wait, I'd much rather be doing this, and went into marketing.
That's right. That's right. And it also shows that if you are just a good person and think logically and mm-hmm. blocking and tackling and good leadership, you can go from industry to industry or different business to different business and be successful. And of course, he's got a very illustrious career doing that. You and I spent a bunch of time just reading a few articles that discussed his tenure at Chipotle. And this was like a couple of years after he'd taken over and all the things that they'd managed to accomplish within that period of time. And a big piece of the puzzle really was the so-called digital channel.
And that's, it actually is a good illustration, I think, of what all the, whether it's fast food or coffee or all these restaurant type operations are fighting, is how do you balance digital things, the store? Because if you get rid of the store, you've got a big problem. On the other hand, people like digital things. So at Chipotle, what he had done is under his tenure, there was an effort which started they called it the digital, what's the word?
A make line.
Digital make line. And a make line is where they assemble what you eat at Chipotle. And there was a big effort with the digital make line, and there was a big effort with beginning to add drive-through to Chipotle because they previously hadn't had drive-through option. To make that all work, they also put a lot of effort into their app so that you could pre-order on the app. And the digital make line is called digital primarily because that's where the digital orders would go so that they wouldn't conflict with the in-store human beings that were ordering in the other make line. So that's the theory, was all of that. I don't know exactly what to make of it, but in fact, it's exactly the kind of problems that Starbucks faces, because Starbucks has three types of orders: drive-through orders, people in the store, and pre-orders via the app. And every Starbucks store fights a battle attempting to balance those. And one of my concerns at Starbucks these days is that, unfortunately, the people who walk into the Starbucks store are at the low end of the totem pole. And so the customers that should be honored for having gotten out of their cars and walked into the store and probably are buying more on average than other people because they see the cups on the shelf or they pick up the bag of coffee or things like that are second class or third class citizens. And so there's a nice thing here, which is I think he's fought these kind of challenges. Maybe he's got some magic to bring to Starbucks.
I think the interesting part for Chipotle, like you were saying, they have a make line because you go down the line and you pick what you want and they make it for you. And they had created a second line to give themselves more bandwidth. And that second line was just like an amorphous additional bandwidth that maybe was underutilized. And they figured that what if we dedicate that to orders that are coming in digitally? And that means our mobile app. So then let's go fix the mobile app. So now we have removed some friction from how easy it is to order it through the mobile app. They came up with some products that were only available on the mobile app. So now if you're interested and if you do a branding advertising a campaign that highlights those new products with the mobile app, you can drive traffic through it and demand through it. And they also figured that their digital line is higher margin, even though it is done on the same store. So that was like the upper half of it. And then the other part was, how do I then distribute it? So then they had in-store pickup, drive-through pickup, and delivery. So they also set up deliveries. So now you actually are feeding the entire value chain from the mobile app to a dedicated ability to fulfill it, to three different ways of distributing it. So now you start looking like iTunes, where you've got the iPod, and then you got the app, and then you got the music, and then you've got the ratings. And now you have three or four or five things that are coming together to build a lot of strength that makes it competitively very strong. So I think, interestingly, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, their drive-through is for pickup only.
I believe so. I think you can the mobile only, app. Yeah, you only go through the drive-through to pick up digital orders. And actually, that's convenient because that's one of the problems at Starbucks is that if you're picking up a digital order, you're competing with the in-store people, and it's very obvious. So it shouts out to the person in the store, wait a minute, what about me, when all these people are streaming in and picking up digital orders that somehow got prioritized
right,
in front of yours.
Right.
I think the thing I will say about Chipotle is, in fact, their numbers have been really good. The most recent annual report shows a 14.3% revenue increase and comp restaurant sales up by almost 8%. Margins are up. It's all very good stuff in there. So I think that you can look at it and say, wow, some really good things here because this is good. What worries me a bit, though, is that it seems like what he did there was related around these kind of with at a distance things like the apps and so forth and so on. I don't think that's Starbucks' problem. I think Starbucks' problem is in the store with, I know that I rarely go to Starbucks these days because at least in Portland, and it's partly store design, partly these priorities, the store feels hostile to those of us who go in. And that's bad because that's really Starbucks's heritage.
That's
and
right.
Howard Schultz has talked about needing to be coffee centric, and coffee centric includes a lot of things that are not digital. So I think on the one hand, he's bringing a lot of really smart stuff and wish him well. And I think he's got good things. I'm concerned by that. I'm also concerned because he's going to stay in Newport, California, and only commute to Seattle. And there's some bad vibes for me in that. It may work out fine. I am not a fan, though, of the remote CEO because he's got a whole culture he's going to have to work and work with. And he probably needs to be in the midst of that culture more than in Newport.
Yeah. In fact, an interesting aspect of the Chipotle story is that he moved the headquarters from Denver, where the company was originally founded, and the original founder has been around and opines and contributes, and but also stays away from day-to-day operation and has given free rein. But they moved the headquarters to Newport Beach, California, and that actually allowed them to also refresh the staff and hire new people, get some fresh blood, more alignment around strategy. That was a pretty interesting combination of moves that obviously is not possible for Starbucks, much, much bigger company. So I think in the early days, that may be okay, because in the early days, the new CEO is probably flying around the world, meeting with stores and suppliers and all of that anyway. And hopefully, like after some months, some kind of an equilibrium emerges and we are a little bit more of a remote culture than we were before. So maybe it's okay. But I agree that if you're the CEO, you need to be there whenever you need to be there. And if it ever gets in the way, then that's a problem.
If I pile that on with the fact that his primary experience is fast food, and then I get fearful because I don't feel fast foodish at Starbucks. Yes, technically it could be considered that. We can classify it, all that. But if Starbucks feels like Taco Bell in any flavor, I don't mean actually three ingredients just combined in 25 different ways. If it's actually feels like I'm being treated like I'd be treated at Taco Bell, that's a problem for him. And that's not the kind of fix they need. Now, it doesn't mean he's going to do that. It's just as people outside observing it, and I've been observing pretty closely lately, there's a mushy reality of people here that there's nothing from his background that quite shows that, except for one comment you found, I think, in the 2019 article, where he observed at some point, look, don't be watching for the big miracle thing. There's just a lot of fundamentals we're getting in place to make things work. And I thought, that's good. That's wisdom.
Yeah.
Too many CEOs come in with their miracle ploy to sell investors on with. But speaking of investors, you and I didn't talk in the pre-call. I just discovered this week, apparently there's a pretty aggressive group of Starbucks investors who are becoming activists and demanding more role in the board and stuff like that. So he'll have some serious challenges. I kind of always dislike, in general, the idea of activist investors because they may point out good investment things, but they rarely understand business well enough to have good ideas about what should happen.
Many of them come across like they just want to extract short-term profit out of the business, come what may. And that, of course, sometimes destroys the company. But obviously, he comes in highly recommended with the success after success. And like you said,
he's a marketing guy. So we like that.
And we like that, exactly. Yes. So we have, may the force be with you.
Yeah, really, absolutely. He's going to need all the support he can get from all of us. Absolutely. Yeah.
So he's going to also need a whole lot of data. And maybe we can conclude with talking about Alistair's article on LinkedIn.
I would love to do that. Some listeners may know Alistair Thompson from the UK, who we talk about every now and then because he's a CFO. So he's a guy that knows the numbers and is all about how does the money work. And he started publishing, putting out posts on LinkedIn lately. And I find most of them are just really interesting. And he's got a very practical sense of business. He's not obsessed with numbers. He's more obsessed with how to use, and numbers are a part of that. This one was titled, Do You Need All That Data? And the opening paragraph says, the world is awash with data. There's no shortage of people who will sell you eye-wateringly expensive software, which allows you to track every little bit of data, build real-time dashboards from it, and download multiple gigabytes to be analyzed in spreadsheeting sheets of mind-numbing complexity. Find me someone running a business like that, and I'll bet they're spending a lot more running the business than they...
Right on. So, A, big fan of Alistair, and you should be too, so look for him. Also, buy his books. He has written two books. One of them is called How to Build a Better Business Plan, and the other one is Cash Flow Surge, 101 no-cost and low-cost fast action strategies to boost your business cash flow. He's also one of the unique combination of finance and marketing. So big fans. And of course, the article just makes perfect sense that data is just data. So it doesn't replace your brain.
What I think actually to one of the distinctions you and I were talking about is one of the problems we have in discussing data is that the truth is data is just data. The fact you and I are having a conversation today is data. But there's a special type of data, which we might call high-tech data, which is stored in databases, processed extensively, purchased from the outside. And a little bit of what he's doing is contrasting those extensive data gatherings of high-tech data with even some of the more common sense data that you can just find in your business. He talks about who do you want greeting your customers when they walk in the store, a friendly, personable good guy, or someone who just got out of jail, essentially. And that's a data point, and it doesn't take much data to say, I think the personal guy is going to be a lot better.
Yeah,
although
definitely.
The guy in jail might be personal. So
yeah, the prison warden, I think it was, that was the personality. But anyway, right on. And it reminds me of a paper that I wrote that I know you read once and parts of it you liked a lot. And like in the parlance of big data and AI, you talk about the volume, velocity, variety, value of data. And that's all the positive aspects of data that compel you to just collect more of it willy-nilly, right? But the flip side is inaccuracy, irrelevance, incompleteness, irreproducibility. So like the four V's meet the four I's. So if the data is irrelevant, then it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how much of it you got. If data is inaccurate, then you're hosed because it's actually actively misleading you. It's better than not having it, right? So you have to be careful.
And one of the quotes I like most from the article is he says, when people hear the word data, they often reach for tech solutions, which is exactly what the tech vendors want you to do. But that's not always necessary. And then he goes on to talk about a data in a factory, which is how do you know when you need to reorder paint? Is you put a line on the tub that says, once it reaches here, reorder, and you have a specific amount you reorder. That doesn't take computer automation. It doesn't take an extensive spreadsheet system. It is a clever, smart, effective way to do it. And I think I particularly responded to that because I think sometimes the world of tech, which you involve in far more than I am, but as an outsider, what I'll find is that the solutions tend to be far more complicated than they need be for things that are very simple. And for example, I've seen a lot of LinkedIn posts about, can you believe how much data people maintain in Excel? Isn't that horrible? And as an owner of a small company, my answer is I couldn't afford the people to put all that stuff into databases. And what I discovered is by having it in Excel, it was available to everybody in the company. And we got a lot of value out of it. Even we were keeping a lot of data in such spreadsheets, and it was actually a very effective way to go about it. But we didn't need fancy three-dimensional transformations on it or things like that for what we were doing.
Yeah, it needs to serve its purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And if the problem you're trying to solve requires it, then it requires it. But if it doesn't, don't over-engineer it because it's cool, because it's going to add more complexity.
Yeah, maybe that's what I'm saying, is that there's a lot of tendency with data to over-engineer. And I can understand it. God, if you know how to do that stuff, it's really fun to add bells and whistles and make it even cleverer and even more clever and better. But when, as a practical user of the data who really just needed to be able to tell a client, no, things are okay. Don't worry about it.
You get that with some consumer products where the more expensive variety has all the bells and whistles that you're never going to use. I don't even know what they do, but you naturally want to get the top of the line. And the top line may very well not be suitable for what you are. See, so it's something like that too. Yeah.
When I bought my Ford Explorer, we intentionally made sure it had the small TV screen in it and not the big one. Because it drives me crazy to have a big honking tablet staring me in the face.
Yeah, I know.
And I feel like I just don't want that. And I understand a lot of people like that. I don't, so I make sure I don't have it.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one too. Yeah. Good stuff. All right. Another episode done, number 47. Thank you,
Absolutely.
Doug.
Absolutely. Thank you, Shaheen.
Thank you all for listening. We appreciate it. And I guess we conclude now.
I guess we can conclude. We should probably conclude to wrap up the Nike story and just say, all right, listeners, just do it.
Just do it. That's
right. And stay away from this like hyper-negative, post-modernist, heavy stuff that ad contains. I don't know how their creatives got lost, but he's got lost.
My advice has been work on being excellent according to your own definition of excellence.
Mm-hmm.
That's all you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right. Thanks again. Thank you all. Until next time. Take care.
Bye.
That's it for this episode of The Marketing Podcast. Every episode is posted on orionx.net and shared on social media. Use the comments section or tweet us with any questions or to propose topics. If you like the show, rate and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. The Marketing Podcast is a production of OrionX. Thank you for listening.